gays and lesbians, to a large extent, have been abused or felt abused or felt unwanted by the Catholic Church in the past. And they have now found the Catholic faith again. And we want to maintain that, that loving circumstance for those people.
I'm a playwright who happens to be gay. Does that make me a gay playwright? I don't know. Maybe if you only write about gay themes, then you're a gay playwright. I don't know. All labels diminish in some way.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Moscow Gays Court Presidential Intervention, Brisbane's Archbishop Finds Sin at St. Mary's, and Edward Albee Plays for Keeps. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 14th, 2009. It's not all that often that an LGBT rights group sues its country's president. But Moscow Pride filed suit this week against Russian President Dmitry Medvedev in the European Court of Human Rights for failing to mediate its long-running rights dispute with Moscow Mayor Yuri Lushkov. The activists appealed to a Russian court last year, asking Medvedev to intervene in the continuing refusal of Mayor Lushkov to grant permits for peaceful LGBT pride demonstrations. Russian law requires the president to reply to appeals within a 30-day period. A Moscow court ruled in July, however, that Medvedev is immune from prosecution. This week's complaint against Medvedev was the seventh rights-related filing in the Eurocourt by Moscow Pride. The sixth, submitted earlier this month, specifically addressed the ban of a demonstration on May 17, 2008, the International Day Against Homophobia, during which protesters planned to demand that Mayor Lushkov be prosecuted for systematically and unlawfully blocking all LGBT Pride events. Moscow Pride says the city's various bans violate provisions of the European Convention on Human Rights, guaranteeing freedom of assembly and protections from discrimination. The group is seeking 100,000 euros in damages. Lushkov has called Pride events satanic and said that the bans prevent gay propaganda from contributing to the spread of HIV and AIDS. Cases before the European Court of Human Rights generally proceed rather slowly. It could be more than a year before any of the lawsuits is heard.
A survey released by Ireland's health ministry has found that almost one-fifth of LGBT people have tried to kill themselves because of abuse and isolation related to their sexual identity. 80% of respondents reported homophobic verbal abuse, 58% said they'd been bullied in school, 40% reported threats of physical violence, and 25% said they'd been beaten up for being gay. The study was done by University College Dublin's School of Education and Trinity College's Children's Research Center.
Britain's PinkNews.com reported this week that an Iranian lesbian has been granted refugee status after a three-year battle with the UK's asylum system. Now 42-year-old Pega Emambagsh escaped from Iran after her partner was arrested, tortured, and subsequently sentenced to death by stoning. Her father was also arrested, interrogated, and tortured for information on her whereabouts. She repeatedly said that her sexual orientation and her past life in Iran would have led to her execution if she were forced to return home. According to the British LGBT rights group Outrage, the Islamic Republic of Iran is qualitatively more homophobic than almost any other state on earth.
A gay male couple who also escaped from Iran in 2005 to avoid arrest and possible execution has won asylum in Canada. 32-year-old Ali and 25-year-old Mohammed arrived in Toronto this week. Their surnames were withheld to protect family members still in Iran. According to a report in the Toronto Sun, the couple originally fled to India, where they sought help from the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to relocate in Canada. Arsham Parsi of Iranian Queer Railroad told the newspaper that the commission made an urgent and high-priority plea at the Canadian Embassy in New Delhi for their resettlement. Iranian Queer Railroad, modeled after the underground railroad that helped slaves from the U.S. South escape to the North in the mid-19th century, said it's helped more than 60 LGBT Iranian refugees resettle in more welcoming locales. It took Ali and Mohammed 3 years to get here, Parsi said. Canada is a gay-friendly country, and they will be successful here.
The Uniting American Families Act was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives this week by New York Democrat Gerald Nadler. It would allow gays and lesbians in relationships with foreign partners to sponsor them for residency in the country. Current immigration law only allows heterosexual sponsorship. Nadler has been fighting for the legislation for the past 8 years. In 2009, he said, "We should be ready as a society to acknowledge that stable American families come in all varieties." The measure, formerly called the Permanent Partners Immigration Act, had 118 co-sponsors in the House last year. Nadler said he's confident of increasing that number in the new Congress. The Senate version, with an initial 10 co-sponsors, is spearheaded by Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy. But he said that immigration reform in general, a political hot potato during the last years of the George W. Bush presidency, suggests an uphill fight for any immigration-related measure. Rachel Tiven of the group Immigration Equality told a media teleconference this week that the estimated 36,000 bi-national lesbi-gay couples living in the U.S. under current law force the foreign partner to jump through hoops to get a limited series of temporary visas or to live in the country illegally, ever fearful of deportation. Many couples who want to stay together eventually have to leave the U.S. altogether. At least 16 countries currently allow residents to sponsor their same-gender partners for legal immigration, including Australia, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Iceland, Israel, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, South Africa, Sweden, and the United Kingdom.
Same-gender couples are observing the annual Freedom to Marry Week across the U.S. in a variety of ways. Many showed up at county clerk offices this week to request marriage licenses they knew would be denied. In New York City, activists wore signs that said, "Just not married." Banners held by couples outside the Marriage Bureau in downtown Las Vegas read, "Don't hate my love." Couples also sought licenses in Orlando, Florida, San Diego and Fresno, California, Austin, Texas, and Omaha, Nebraska. Rejected couples in Richmond and Charlottesville mocked their state's marketing slogan, "Virginia is for lovers."
Several couples were also turned away from marriage license bureaus in Salt Lake City, Utah. One couple said they didn't feel like they were walking out of the clerk's office empty-handed. They're planning a commitment ceremony in California this April, and as one of them said, "Whether the state shows up or not is up to them. But our family, our friends, and God will be there." And a sign outside the Allentown, Pennsylvania City Hall, where a few couples tried to get licenses, read, "Can we vote on your marriage now?"
Several same-gender couples who got hitched in San Francisco in 2004, when Mayor Gavin Newsom authorized marriage licenses for them, celebrated the event's fifth anniversary with a ceremony in the City Hall Rotunda as part of Freedom to Marry Week. While the state Supreme Court invalidated those marriages, many of those couples wed again during the 5 months last year after the same court made them legal. The voter-approved Proposition 8, which revoked the Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling, is being challenged as unconstitutional in that court, as are the validity of some 18,000 same-gender marriages legally conducted from mid-June until that November 4th vote. Dozens of people in Beverly Hills attended a ceremony on the steps of the courthouse to celebrate the renewal of wedding vows by Robin Tyler and Diane Olson, the first same-gender couple in Southern California to legally marry, and in that same place last June. "It's not about marriage," Tyler said. "Now it's about the Constitution."
Dozens of equality activists gathered outside the Maine House and Senate to distribute Valentine's Day cards urging support for a recently introduced bill to legalize same-gender marriage in that state. Hundreds rallied in the Minnesota state capital of St. Paul and in the Rhode Island capital of Providence to support marriage equality bills progressing through their respective legislatures.
Meanwhile, Hawaii's House of Representatives voted 33-17 this week for a civil unions bill that would grant same-gender couples almost all the rights of marriage but the name. The legislation now goes to the state Senate Judiciary Committee, where the vote is reportedly split among six senators with one undecided. A tie vote would kill the measure for the year.
And finally, Pride was celebrated recently under the summertime sun in two Southern Hemisphere locales. In the Australian state of Victoria, Police Chief Christine Nixon joined about 4,000 participants along St. Kilda's Fitzroy Street in the city's 14th annual Pride Parade. She drew considerable criticism when she first joined the annual march in 2002, but her continued support for LGBT people probably made her the most popular participant this year. She was led by Victoria Police's bagpipe band, with a contingent of about 30 uniformed officers behind her. About 100 groups and other state officials also marched in the parade. And New Zealand Prime Minister John Key danced with drag queens during Auckland's 10th annual Big Gay Out this week, an event originally designed to provide a safe space for LGBT people and to promote AIDS awareness. The Prime Minister also tried his hand at some of the carnival games at the festival, where people also beat the hot sun by gliding on a lubricant-enhanced water slip-and-slide and were then hosed off by members of the New Zealand Fire Service. Opposition leader Phil Goff, Green Party MP Kevin Haig, and Auckland Mayor John Banks also reportedly joined in the celebration. About 8,000 partygoers watched the PM boogie on stage with drag duo Buffy and Bimbo, who also offered him a massage to remember, which Mr. Key politely declined.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 14th, 2009. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Scenes from Life of the Absurd with playwright who's gay, Edward Albee, later in the program.
The church is on fire.
LGBT Catholics and their liberal compatriots have had plenty of bad news in recent weeks. The latest rash of insults began with Pope Benedict XVI's Christmas message, in which he compared lesbian-gay equality and gender rights to environmental degradation. Shortly thereafter, the pontiff revoked the excommunication of an illegitimately ordained bishop who denies that there was a Holocaust, and promoted to bishop a priest who proclaimed that Hurricane Katrina was divine retribution on LGBT-friendly New Orleans. Now the spotlight has fallen on the South Brisbane, Australia congregation of St. Mary's, where Archbishop John Bathersby has fired progressive parish priest Peter Kennedy. Among Father Kennedy's sins are allowing lay people, including women, to preach and cultivating a community that openly welcomes lesbians and gays. This Way Out correspondent Mark Jeffrey commiserated with St. Mary's Community Council gay and lesbian representative Vince Gannout.
The bishop's letter actually had the removal of Peter Kennedy as one of six items. The rest of the items also reflect on the gay and lesbian community to the extent that they're removing the 6:30 p.m. Mass on a Saturday evening and also the 5 p.m. on the Sunday evening, which is the one where the majority of gays and lesbians would attend. Mm. So unless they're prepared to go under this new arrangement to a 7 a.m. Mass or a 9 a.m. Mass, that there won't be a facility for them for Mass on a Sunday.
I mean, the gay and lesbian community at St. Mary's is quite broad and involved in pretty well all the services and pretty well every part of the church. That hasn't really been mentioned at all in the Archbishop's correspondence, but it seems to be a smack in the teeth.
Well, we are afraid. There's no question about that. But where our concern lies is the gays and lesbians, to a large extent, have been abused or felt unwanted by the Catholic Church in the past. And they have now found the Catholic faith again. And they love it there, they feel welcome, and they feel as if they're now Catholics alive again. Mm. And we want to maintain that, that loving circumstance for those people, that they feel affirmed, they feel, you know, human, they feel loved at that time. So we need to preserve that.
It's a very safe space to be. A few years ago, there was a guy that I met who was over from Canada studying for a while, and he was also a guy with a strong sense of spirituality. We went to St. Mary's several times, and even towards the end of the time, I was able to be there at the Mass, take communion, sing, and you know, with my arm around him and tears rolling down my cheeks, and it was no one batted an eyelid.
No, no. And you'll get somebody who might even come up and say, hey, it's okay to be gay, and you'll think, oh, this person's gay, where in fact, no, he's a husband, middle-aged or even late 30s with children, and he's just, we are all members of the community. One of the great watersheds of coming out for those people who do come out is the sense of freedom, and you get that at St. Mary's. St. Mary's is on the resource books of quite a few doctors and psychologists around Brisbane, where people who do have sexuality problems, particularly in the gay and lesbian area, they quite often will get recommended, pop along to St. Mary's 5 o'clock Mass and just see how you go.
So we don't really know what's going to happen come February 21. You've just come from a meeting of the steering committee there, which we won't go into the details of that. That'll all unfold in the next week or two.
A particular topic of tonight's meeting was how we are going to address the issues for the gays and lesbians, how are we going to look after them. We are considering just actually a direct approach to the proposed new administrator to say, hey, this is our situation. How are you going to address it? This is how we'd like you to address it. This is how we could work with you to address it, to maintain this connection with these people. How that person addresses it himself and responds, we don't know. The Gay and Lesbian Choir practice area every Tuesday night, what arrangements are going to take place? Are they going to continue? What changes would be needed? But we still have to look for and on behalf of the Gay and Lesbian Choir to do that. Previously, the members of the community and other members of the diocese in Brisbane have written to the bishop in very positive terms, etc. However, the bishop has been very adamant he will not talk.
He wants to talk just with the priest that he's put in charge. They're the administrator, which he's now sacking, and he doesn't really want to talk to the community.
No. No, but it is a community that is the whole body of the church.
It's a very old Catholic way of doing things, the hierarchical pope to bishop to priest to community. But the way it seems to be working at the moment is totally ignoring the 1,300 strong people. That's how many were there on the weekend across the three masses.
That's right. Well, the Catholic Church is an autocracy, not a democracy. And that's the way it's always been.
And the point is, over the last few months, as things have unfolded there's not a hatred or a disrespect or a massive vendetta or evil intent against the Archbishop that's coming through from the community. It's like we just want to exist and do what we're doing.
That's correct. As a faith community, it is the Catholic faith in substance that we're looking at, not the form, not the performance, not the robes that a priest might have to wear.
Yeah.
Because the priests at St. Mary's don't wear robes.
They don't go around naked, but you know.
No. They wear the sacramental stole at the appropriate times throughout the service. But they don't get around in these colourful garbs of the mid-centuries at all.
Exactly. Being there on the weekend was amazing. People from a whole range of ages, genders, sexualities. It was just such a broad community. People in wheelchairs, disabilities, just single parents. It was just a fantastic environment. It always has been.
Yes, it has been. Yeah.
And we really hope it continues. Thanks for coming in tonight, Vince. We're talking to Vince Kinnert, who's a part of the community at St. Mary's South Brisbane that's going through monumental change at the moment. What the hell that means over the next 2 weeks, we don't know. I'm Mark Jeffrey.
And our thanks to John Frame for production assistance. Archbishop Battersby has ordered Father Kennedy to vacate St. Mary's Church or risk arrest. We'll continue to follow this story.
And I don't believe when they say this. God turns his back on the Jew, the black, the Muslim, the gay. Show me where Jesus said to me, you're not all children of God.
Coming up with a brief but clever introduction for Edward Albee is no doubt a fool's errand. America's leading Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright provocateur, author of The Zoo Story, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and so many others, calls his plays a stand against the fiction that everything in this slipping land of ours is peachy keen. Albee had a delightful conversation about being gay, not to mention art, life, and death, with This Way Out correspondents Dixie Treichel and John Townsend.
I was an orphan. I was adopted into a rich family. Their values were, I thought, pretty unfortunate. Even very young, I didn't like their values. My adoptive family took me down to Palm Beach, Florida every winter when they had a house on the ocean. You can't imagine how terrible Palm Beach was. Black people had to leave the island of Palm Beach by sunset. Of course, no Jews were allowed to have property there. How I turned out to be a human being, in spite of all of that, I really don't know. Maybe because I was not theirs.
As you were deciding to become a playwright...
I decided to become a playwright because I failed at everything else.
So you wrote some fiction and poetry as well, right?
Sure. I started off with poetry. I wrote the two worst novels that could ever be written by an American teenager. But I figured out that I was a writer since I was incompetent to become a composer, which is what I wanted first.
Oh, I notice in your plays that they're very musical.
Yeah, they are indeed.
Some of your influences...
Well, I had more influences than you can possibly imagine since I read more than most kids, listened to more classical music than most kids, and looked at art more than most kids did. So I was being happily bombarded constantly by the other arts.
What happened then when you actually began to write plays?
With the exception of one play I wrote when I was 12 and a half, except for that, I didn't write my first play, The Zoo Story, until I was 28, and I'd failed at all of the branches of writing. When I wrote The Zoo Story, I realized something interesting. Edward, this is better than anything else you've ever written, and this may be okay. When I wrote that play, I had a sense, you know?
How do you think American theater has changed from when you were young to what's happening today?
The terrible commercial things that have happened to theater. The awful killing hand of commerce has really done serious damage to our theater. The costs of producing a play now are prohibitive, and the cost of an audience going to a play is absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. When we did my play, The Zoo Story, on Crap's Last Tape off-Broadway in 1960, the tickets were $2.50. Now off-Broadway, the tickets are $75, and inflation hasn't done that. With inflation, it would only be a third of that. All of the costs have gone up, and so you can't get young people going to the theater, and you can't get low-income people going to the theater, and that's who we need there.
Well, and you've talked about the need for people to be rebellious and for young people to rebel against things, and that comes up in your plays.
Yeah, but only against the things that should be rebelled against. That's what's wrong with our educational system. We don't educate people in something that used to be called civics, where you were taught how government functions and where the errors are. Nobody's taught that stuff anymore, so a lot of people are rebelling without knowing how to fix anything. I used to talk to students in the early 60s during the rebellious times, and their hearts were in the right place, their minds were in the right place, but you couldn't talk a dialectic to them for more than 2 minutes before they were out of their depth. That was a shame. If they'd known more specifically about how to fix what they were angry about, we could have accomplished a lot more.
Mr. Albee, you've talked about the need for arts education as well, and can you tell us a little bit about why we're not having that?
You can't have a civilization without a comprehensive arts understanding in the country. Our public schools do not teach the arts. I went to private schools, being adopted by that rich family. I went to private schools. I got a great education. And most people aren't getting that education now, and it's terrible, and we're supposed to be a civilization.
Do you view your work as dark comedy?
I don't think in those terms. I think of what I write as plays. Dark comedy, light tragedy? No, I don't think in those terms. It's a play. It's something I want people to go to and pay attention to. What the characters say, what they don't say, what the meanings are, the implications are. Knowing that no two people see the same play, which is very important to remember.
You've always rejected labels, even the term absurdist playwright, even though you're considered by many people America's first great absurdist
playwright. Yeah, because most people don't know what the term means.
You've also rejected gay playwright.
Well, I'm a playwright who happens to be gay. Does that make me a gay playwright? I don't know. Maybe if you only write about gay themes, then you're a gay playwright. I don't know. All labels diminish in some way.
When you started writing, was there a gay community around? I mean, were people out then, or did people...
You mean when I was nine, living at home, started writing poetry?
You did a lot of your formative artistic growth in Greenwich Village, and so there was quite a gay scene in that area.
Remember, my family sent me to private schools, and they sent me away to boarding schools, and boy, boarding schools. I came out as soon as it was possible, and I've enjoyed being gay ever since. I had no trouble with it, whatever.
Is there something that you would like to say that you really want people to know and nobody asks you?
After 35 years with a great lover, I've been single for 4 years now. In case anybody's interested in an 80-year-old.
You were friends with Ned Roram and...
Oh, sure, I still see Ned. He's doing pretty well. He gained a little weight, which he should lose.
Harold Pinter, old friend of yours, passed away.
Yes, Harold and I were good friends.
Harold Pinter was the great British playwright.
Harold and I were both very much affected by Sam Beckett, one of the greatest playwrights of the second half of the 20th century. But I think we both managed to develop our own sound and our own language, so the influence was helpful and not limiting. I admired Harold's political stances, and I admired his plays a lot, and we liked each other a lot.
Is there a play that you've written that you like more than others?
It's always the one that I'm writing now.
And are you writing one now?
I'm writing two.
I always have
two in my head. One is a relief from the other.
Now, are you going to tell us about what they are?
No, if I'm wrong?
You speak about death in your plays a lot.
Well, there are only two things to write about, life and death.
And which is your favorite?
You know, we've got death ahead of us, all of us, and we better participate in living as much as we can, as long as we can.
Going to the theater should make you participate in your own life. You've said things to that effect.
I don't think you should go to the theater and not have anything happen to you. I think every time you go to any art experience, you should be changed, or you should learn something about yourself that you didn't know before. That's the only way you can keep your own intellect evolving.
That was living legend Edward Albee in conversation with soon-to-be legendary Dixie Trykle and John Townsend. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Mark Jeffrey with John Frain, and Dixie Trykle and John Townsend contributed program material. Musically, you heard excerpts from Show Me by Christian Andresen, and Wen Xin Yang with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra performed some of composer Ned Roram's Cello Concerto. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, Aero FM Masterton, New Zealand, KEUL Girdwood and Hope, Alaska, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.